Welcome to the Politocrat. I'm Omar Moore. It is Sunday, January the 16th, 2022. On this edition of the Politocrat, part two of Dr. King Weekend, Martin Luther King Jr. Weekend here in the United States. More on Dr. King and his accomplishments for civil rights, the movement, and more coming up next.
Well, I'm delighted to be here, Harry, and I'll tell you one of the reasons I'm so happy to be here. I flew out of Washington this afternoon, and as soon as we started out, they notified us that the plane had mechanical difficulties, and I don't want to give you an impression that as a Baptist preacher, I don't have faith in God in the air. It's simply that I've had more experience with him on the ground.
That was Martin Luther King Jr. in February of 1968 with Harry Belafonte on The Tonight Show. For 1 week in 1968, February of that particular year, Harry Belafonte sat in for Johnny Carson and did the Tonight Show hosting duties. And during that week, one of the guests was Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And you heard him there in a very chipper mood and with a sense of humor that we obviously had not seen throughout much of the time that he was in the public spotlight. But he was a very humorous person, was Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Always one to crack a joke here and there. And the thing is that, of course, the corporate news media did not cover that side of him, and obviously what he was about was all very serious indeed. And so I guess there wasn't enough time, or much time, for the media, I guess, to show Dr. King in those moments of levity, and he had a lot of moments of those. I guess the corporate news media chose not to show Dr. King as that more fully rounded human being that he was. Of course, Dr. King was somebody who liked to laugh as well. So that was from The Tonight Show with Harry Belafonte back in February of 1968. I just thought, dear listener, that I would play that for you. And just in case, because a lot of people have never heard that clip. It is from a documentary called The Sit-In, and that is available actually streaming on Peacock. It's exclusive to Peacock. If you have Peacock, please go and make sure you watch it. PeacockTV.com for more, and you can find it there. And I think it does require a subscription. It depends on where you are in the world and what cable service you have and the rest of it. You can, I think, subscribe to Peacock separately, but the whole point is that whatever your scenario is with Peacock, make sure that if you do have Peacock TV, PeacockTV.com, if you go to that website, you may have to subscribe. Bottom line is that's where you'll find The Sit-In. It is a fascinating documentary about that 1 week in 1968, in February of that year, that Harry Belafonte hosted that particular show. And Dr. King was among the many guests on it. And Dr. King, as I've said, someone who had a really good sense of humor, a very funny sense of humor, a good sense of humor. And you heard it right there. And my goodness me, Dr. King, that was February of 68. Now, just 2 months after that, he would be assassinated. I want to talk about Dr. King and what he did in the earlier part of the 1960s. And I want to spend this part two, and welcome to it, dear listener, as we go through this Sunday in the second of three parts of the Dr. King holiday weekend special episodes of the Politocrat Daily Podcast. Dr. King was more than a monumental human being. He was an absolute towering figure of conscience in the United States and across the world, known throughout the world as one of the world's greatest ever orator, and also known as one of the foremost persons of conscience and activism and civil disobedience, nonviolent civil disobedience. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was hard at work every single day to make the United States and the world a better place for us all, and inspired us all in that cause as well to be better ourselves. He was somebody who you will not see the likes of again, of course. anywhere on the planet. He was a special, special human being who, you know, was not without his flaws. I'm not going to sit here and deify him, but I will say that, like every human being, Dr. King had his flaws. But the thing is that Dr. King was someone who inspired you to act and to change, and he inspired a nation to rise up to what he thought were its greater beliefs and its greater truths and its greater abilities, I should say, is probably the best word to use. Dr. King, let's go back, shall we? And I want to read this passage, actually, before I even get to going back a little bit. This is a quote of his from his book, actually. It's from his book called Why We Can't Wait, which is a very important book that I urge you to buy now. Buy this book. Buy the book, Why We Can't Wait, by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. This is from pages 24 and 25 from the book. And let me just read this to you, dear listener. There were no more powerful moments in the Birmingham episode than during the closing days of the campaign, when Negro youngsters ran after white policemen asking to be locked up. There was an element of unmalicious mischief in this. The Negro youngsters, although perfectly willing to submit to imprisonment, knew that we had already filled up the jails and that the police had no place left to take them. When for decades you have been able to make a man compromise his manhood by threatening him with a cruel and unjust punishment, and when suddenly he turns upon you and says, quote, punish me, I do not deserve it, but because I do not deserve it, I will accept it, so that the world will know that I am right and you are wrong, end quote, you hardly know what to do. You feel defeated and secretly ashamed. You know that this man is as good a man as you are, that from some mysterious source he has found the courage and the conviction to meet physical force with soul force. That was from the book by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., entitled Why We Can't Wait, pages 24 and 25. I'm going to read another passage from that book a little bit later on, but that gives you an idea of the essence of the man, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. It was an act of selflessness described in that moment that I just read out. It was a principled act. It was a moral act. It was a moral, meaning a space, moral, M-O-R-A-L, not immoral, amoral, and not immoral in, you know, having no morals or without morals, a moral act. It was an act of morality, let me put it that way, for that to happen. Because it was about taking on the consciousness of those who oppressed, of the white power structure, of those tools of the white power structure, and put that seed in their mind that told them that what they were doing was wrong. That is what Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and the civil rights movement, the human rights movement around him, was doing throughout the 1960s and previous to that in the 1950s with Rosa Parks, beginning the Montgomery bus boycott in Montgomery, Alabama. That was what that was about, pricking the moral consciousness and planting that, even in the oppressor, knowing that you are wrong for what you're doing, even as the people who are right submit to the wrongdoing to make a greater and larger point. And that's what that excerpt was about there that I just read out from the book Why We Can't Wait. That's a really important book, and I urge you to read it, dear listener. It's an important book, and I actually plan to give away a copy of that book, and I'm going to announce that on Monday, tomorrow's episode. So at least on Monday, I will put that on Twitter, I should say, because I think it's really important that you read that book. I mean, there's two great books from Dr. Martin Luther King, and he wrote a third one as well, I think. that was somewhat autobiographical. But this particular book, Why We Can't Wait, is a very good one, as is the book that I have talked about as well from time to time on the Political Daily Podcast, Chaos or Community. Where do we go from here? Chaos or Community. Very important book as well. But the book that I am going to be giving away, and I will announce that I will be giving this away on Monday on Twitter at the Popcorn REEL, is a book called Why We Can't Wait. Very important book by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., as I have said before, was a Baptist preacher, Baptist minister, and grew up in the Christian church, of course, and was a part of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, SCLC. And again, he had people like the Reverend Jesse Jackson. I haven't even really mentioned Reverend Jackson yet, but he had people like the Reverend Jesse Jackson at his side as his right-hand man. He had a number of right-hand men, including Ralph Abernathy and Bayard Rustin and Diane Nash. She's female, obviously, but Diane Nash was someone who was also in that circle. There was actually, I think it was Dorothy Cotton, who was the only woman, actually, so I should correct myself. Diane Nash was not necessarily directly in the inner circle, but she was certainly knew Dr. King well. And I should say also that Dorothy Cotton, I believe, was the only woman who was really in the inner circle for Dr. King. But the fact of the matter is that Dr. King had a number of trusted people, lieutenants, if you will, who were around him, trusted lieutenants, if you will, who were around him. And again, Amelia Boynton was an important figure who really planned out the strategy for the Selma March. And that's something that needs to be recognized as well. Dr. King, and if I go back here so that we can just kind of look back at where he evolved and where he went from. In 1956, of course, in 1955-56, Montgomery bus boycott was the thing that put him on the map, really, along with Rosa Parks. And it was Rosa Parks' action who, before anyone else knew, was one of the key moments in that movement. In fact, there was a woman before Rosa Parks who put things in motion. And there was, a political decision to not focus on her as the standard bearer of the movement. I guess there were some things perhaps in her background that perhaps some of the people involved deemed not to be so, good, or not to be so clean cut, if you will. So they chose Rosa Parks after Rosa Parks did a similar act of civil disobedience by sitting in the white section of a Montgomery bus a few weeks or months after. And so because of that, what happened there, that was the choice that they went to, and Rosa Parks became the person who was lauded. And Rosa Parks did a lot of work after that. But I want to talk about Dr. King here in 1963. One of the very important parts of 1963, among many other things, of course, we know. Well, let me just start like this. In April of 1963, April 16th of 1963, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., after being arrested, wrote the very famous, legendary letter from Birmingham jail. And what's extraordinary about the letter, dear listener, is that the letter began, if you can visualize this, on the margins of a newspaper. And this letter was in response to a critique of Dr. King by several clergymen from the South. Many of these people were moderates, actually, and white moderates. Many of them were, and I think all of them were. And Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., while in jail, had an opportunity to read that statement that was printed in one of the local papers, I think, down in Alabama. And he responded to it by writing a lengthy response. And that response actually started on the margins of a newspaper that he had had with him. And what also happened is that after that, it evolved in terms of where he wrote that. Because he wrote this on the newspaper that had the statement from these white clergymen on it. And he was writing in response to the notes, or writing the actual letter on that, the margins of that newspaper. And I don't know what the name of the newspaper was, but the bottom line is that he ended up writing more and more, not just on the margins of the newspaper, but he also, I guess, had a legal pad that he wrote on that he was given while he was in prison, while he was in jail. And it took a long time for that pad, quite a bit of time before that legal pad was given to him. And when he finally got that legal pad, he just continued to write away and write and write and write and write and write and write. And that became the letter from Birmingham Jail. In 1963, April the 16th of that year, 1963, as I've said. And I'm just going to read to you just a couple of pages, because it's quite long. And I urge you, dear listener, to read Letter from Birmingham Jail. I guess one of these days, maybe one of these days, I might just decide to read the entire thing on an episode. But my goodness me, there are lots and lots and lots of pages of it. It's probably better that you actually read it for yourself. I think it would sit with you in a way that is profound, rather than me boring you with reading it. It might be better that you do, because I would urge you to do that. You can find it in a number of different places, but I'm going to read to you just a portion of it. I turn some of these pages here. Of this book, and I just really think that it is important to read this particular clip that I'm going to read, because I just think that it is very important. I'm going to read a couple of areas of this particular letter. Letter from Birmingham Jail, April 16th, 1963. This is Dr. Martin Luther King who wrote this, and I'm going to read you a couple of things that I think resonate here. And I think you will find them to resonate as well, especially now as we are in 2022. I must make two honest confessions to you, my Christian and Jewish brothers. First, I must confess that over the past few years, I have been gravely disappointed with the white moderate. I have almost reached the regrettable conclusion that the Negro's great stumbling block in his stride toward freedom is not the white citizen's counselor or the Ku Klux Klanner, but the white moderate, who is more devoted to order than to justice, who prefers a negative peace, which is the absence of tension, to a positive peace, which is the presence of justice, who constantly says, quote, "I agree with you in the goal you seek, but I cannot agree with your methods of direct action," end quote, who paternalistically believes he can set the timetable for another man's freedom, who lives by a mythical concept of time, and who constantly advises the Negro to wait for a, quote, "more convenient season," end quote. Shallow understanding from people of goodwill is more frustrating than absolute misunderstanding from people of ill will. Lukewarm acceptance is much more bewildering than outright rejection. I had hoped that the white moderate would understand that law and order exist for the purpose of establishing justice, and that when they fail in this purpose, they become the dangerously structured dams that block the flow of social progress. I had hoped that the white moderate would understand that the present tension in the South is a necessary phase of the transition from an obnoxious negative peace in which the Negro passively accepted his unjust plight to a substantive and positive peace in which all men will respect the dignity and worth of human personality. Actually, we who engage in non-violent direct action are not the creators of tension. We merely bring to the surface the hidden tension that is already alive. We bring it out in the open where it can be seen and dealt with. Like a boil that can never be cured so long as it is covered up, but must be opened with all its ugliness to the natural medicines of air and light. Injustice must be exposed with all the tension its exposure creates to the light of human conscience and the air of national opinion before it can be cured. Now that is a portion of Letter from Birmingham Jail, written by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. on April the 16th, 1963. And that passage is so important because it still stands today. White moderates blocking social progress. Hello? Senator Joe Manchin, Senator Kyrsten Sinema, white moderates in the Democratic Party blocking social progress. Hello? Can I get an amen? Can I get an amen? Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., when he wrote Letter from Birmingham Jail, was writing about Senator Joe Manchin and Senator Kyrsten Sinema. Those are the kinds of people he was writing about. And those clergymen, those white clergymen, those moderates who were criticizing Dr. King in their statement that he was responding to with Letter from Birmingham Jail. That is what was going on. And Dr. King was explaining how dangerous, quite frankly, the white moderate is. And I totally agree, and I think we've all seen this in 2020, in 2021, and in 2022, how white moderates are blocking more social progress than anyone else, quite frankly. It's obvious that the Republicans are, yes, that's no question. But the point is that this was an opportunity for voting rights to flourish in 2022, and two white moderates blocked it. That is the thing that Dr. King was talking about. There's going to be a vote on voting rights, actually, on Tuesday. It was supposed to, I guess, be on Monday, but it's going to be on Tuesday now. So in a few days' time, you're going to be hearing about this. And this voting rights attempt is probably going to fail, most likely, because they don't have the votes. Quite simply, there's not going to be an override of the filibuster rules because, of course, you've seen that, and I played this a few days ago now, that Manchin and Sinema are not going along with it. And so Birmingham Jail, the letter from Birmingham Jail, exemplified the points of what I've been talking about. And again, the greatest obstacle to progress is often, very often, the white moderate, and sometimes as well the white liberal. So this is the thing Dr. King was arguing in that portion of the letter, that at least you know where the KKK terrorists stand. You know where they stand very clearly. You know exactly where they stand. And, you know, you know that, where they stand, and you can see that where they stand. It's very clear to you. And Dr. King believed in bringing things out in the open, as you obviously heard in that passage there from Letter from Birmingham Jail. Dr. King appealing once again to the urgency of now, as he's talked about, the fierce urgency of now. This is the time to act. This is the time to put this out in the open. And you can't just hide it away. And he just talked about that in that piece of the letter. And the thing is also, you can't camouflage this. You've got to bring it out in the open and deal with it and have everybody understand it, because everyone knows there's a tension. You walk down the street, you feel a certain tension, particularly when someone who is white is walking down the street in the direction going past you. You can see that before you get to the point where you pass each other, there's still in this country, in the United States, and I'm sure in other countries, a tension that evolves and exists between those two people as they walk. And you can certainly feel it when you walk, especially the streets of the United States. And you can see it in the face, as I have done as a black man, seen that in the faces of some of the white people who I walk past or who walk past me. And this is the thing that Dr. King wanted to bring out in the open. And the white clergy who had written a statement saying, oh, how dare you do this? Civil disobedience. Oh my gosh, you can't do it like this. We understand your goal and we agree with you on that, but we just don't like the fact that you're going and you're blocking entrances and you're sitting in at lunch counters and you're doing this and you're doing that and you're doing boycotts and that. Oh, we don't like that. Well, if you don't like that, then you don't like any of the message that Dr. King and the movement around him and with him had to deliver, and the consciousness raising that they were doing. And so that's what Dr. King was talking about. I'm going to come back with another reading from Letter from Birmingham Jail, another excerpt that I'm going to read to you, dear listener, on this special episode, episode 2 of 3, part 2 of Dr. King Holiday Weekend on the Politocrat Daily Podcast. Thank you very much indeed for joining me. I'll be right back with more from Letter from Birmingham Jail right after this. Welcome back. Dear listener, it is very good to have you here on this particular episode of The Politocrat, a very special edition, this Sunday edition of The Politocrat. In fact, these 3 episodes, this is the second of them, this weekend for Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Holiday Weekend here in the United States, special episodes of The Politocrat Daily Podcast, 3 episodes, because I think you need more than one to talk about Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and what he meant to the civil rights movement, the human rights movement, what he meant to the United States of America, what he meant to the world, what he meant to black people all over the world, the kind of moral conscience, what he meant actually to people who were white, who believed in the things that he believed in. And he being Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., of course. And Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was someone who, and I'll talk about this in a few minutes, expanded his horizons and grew a movement outward, not inward, you know. And sometimes movements do end up crumbling in that way when you try to keep those movements very tight-knit, as, you know, movements have shown over history. But when you grow a movement from the inside and grow it out, movements can become very, very powerful. And Dr. King did that. And I'll talk about that in a little bit. But I want to get back to what I promised I would get back to, which is reading a second portion of Letter from Birmingham Jail, which was written by Dr. King in April of 1963, April 16th, to be precise, 1963. And again, I should say, just to remind you, dear listener, Letter from Birmingham Jail was a response to a statement put out by white moderate clergy in a newspaper. I guess it was a local newspaper. I don't remember exactly what the newspaper, where it was. But the bottom line is that the statement by the white clergy in that newspaper, whichever newspaper it was, heavily criticized Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And their white moderates, the white clergy who put the statement out, had condemned Dr. King for his tactics of nonviolent civil disobedience. Why would you condemn nonviolence? That's something that's really bizarre to me. And these are clergymen doing it. Why would that? What's wrong with that picture? What could possibly go wrong there? You know, clergy condemning nonviolent tactics of civil disobedience. Oh, we don't like this sitting in at lunch counters. We don't like this sitting across a street, blocking a road, blocking a highway. We don't like all that. We don't like those methods. It's not good. We don't like it. There's a better way to do it, you know. So Dr. King responded, as I said before the break, first on the very newspaper that contained the statement, and he was writing on the margins of that newspaper. Then he was finally allowed to have legal pads brought in from his own attorneys. And then he wrote a much more and continued expansive response to this particular statement released by white clergy through the press. And so what I'm going to do now, dear listener, is read the second of the 2 excerpts that I wanted to read from Letter from Birmingham Jail from Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. This is the second excerpt. I have tried to stand between these 2 forces, saying that we need emulate neither the do-nothingism of the complacent nor the hatred and despair of the black nationalist, For there is the more excellent way of love and nonviolent protest. I am grateful to God that, through the influence of the Negro Church, the way of nonviolence became an integral part of our struggle. If this philosophy had not emerged, by now many streets of the South would, I am convinced, be flowing with blood. And I am further convinced that if our white brothers dismiss as rabble-rousers and outside agitators those of us who employ nonviolent direct action, and if they refuse to support our nonviolent efforts, millions of Negroes will, out of frustration and despair, seek solace and security in black nationalist ideologies, a development that would inevitably lead to a frightening racial nightmare. Oppressed people cannot remain oppressed forever. The yearning for freedom eventually manifests itself, and that is what has happened to the American Negro. Something within has reminded him of his birthright of freedom, and something without has reminded him that it can be gained. Consciously or unconsciously, he has been caught up by the zeitgeist, and with his black brothers of Africa and his brown and yellow brothers of Asia, South America, and the Caribbean, the United States Negro is moving with a sense of great urgency toward the promised land of racial justice. If one recognizes this vital urge that has engulfed the Negro community, one should readily understand why public demonstrations are taking place. The Negro has many pent-up resentments and latent frustrations, and he must release them. So let him march. Let him make prayer pilgrimages to City Hall. Let him go on freedom rides and try to understand why he must do so. If his repressed emotions are not released in nonviolent ways, they will seek expression through violence. This is not a threat, but a fact of history. So I have not said to my people, get rid of your discontent. Rather, I have tried to say that this normal and healthy discontent can be channeled into the creative outlet of nonviolent direct action. And now this approach is being termed extremist. But though I was initially disappointed at being categorized as an extremist, as I continued to think about the matter, I gradually gained a measure of satisfaction from the label. Was not Jesus an extremist for love? Love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you? Was not Amos an extremist for justice? Let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream? Was not Paul an extremist for the Christian gospel? I bear in my body the marks of the Lord Jesus. Was not Martin Luther an extremist? Here I stand, I cannot do otherwise, so help me God. And John Bunyan, I will stay in jail to the end of my days before I make a butchery of my conscience. And Abraham Lincoln, this nation cannot survive half slave and half free. And Thomas Jefferson, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. So the question is not whether we will be extremists, but what kind of extremists will we be? Will we be extremists for hate or for love? Will we be extremists for the preservation of injustice or for the extension of justice? That is the second excerpt that I just read there from Letter from Birmingham Jail that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. wrote on April the 16th, 1963. A couple of things about that passage. One, he talks about black nationalism and this racial nightmare that would happen. Now, Dr. King, in 1963, certainly was at loggerheads with Malcolm X. The both of them kind of jabbed at each other. Mainly, it was coming from Malcolm X, who quite often took issue with Dr. King's approaches to gaining justice for black people in the United States, and decried Christianity and the quote-unquote turn the other cheek of that religion. So Dr. King and Malcolm X certainly went back and forth on that. Malcolm did not say some very kind things about Dr. King, let's put it that way. And I think you know what those things were. and the names that he was called. But as they met, and they met, by the way, in 1965, the only time they had ever met, I think it was March of 1965, on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C., and they shook hands briefly, had some pictures taken, and they met there, I think, for some kind of, I forgot what the event was. Quite frankly, I should know, but I'd forgotten it at the minute. But that was the only time they'd ever met in March of 1964, not March of 1965, because, of course, Dr. Malcolm X had been assassinated in February of 65. So I apologize, dear listener. Obviously, it was not March of 65. I believe it was March of 1964 was the only time that they ever got to meet. And that was in D.C., in Washington, the nation's capital. But they jibed at each other, sparred with each other. But they actually converged later on in terms of their philosophies converged, and they were remarkably similar, actually, as things went the way they did. So I will go into that a bit as well in a few moments. But that's where Dr. King was in 1963 when he wrote Letter from Birmingham Jail, when he talked about the nightmare of black radicalism. And of course, the thing is that black radicals were not violent at that time, which is the ironic thing. You know, Stokely Carmichael, who was, I think at one point, I think either one of the, he was first of all in SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and I think had been the head of that organization before moving on to the Black Panther Party. Stokely Carmichael talked about all power to all the people, power to the people, and black liberation was such an important thing. And he talked about those things. And the Black Panthers were never violent. And so it was very interesting that Dr. King would say there would be this black nationalist nightmare, radical and racial nightmare, which there really wasn't, because, of course, what happened was is that the Black Panthers were being killed by police and by the FBI. So that was the real nightmare. It was not anything to do with anything or anyone, I should say, in the Black Panthers being violent, because they simply weren't. So they were a nonviolent group. And all they cared about was education and justice and clean running water and good housing and people being fed. That's what the Black Panthers did, and self-defense and self-determination. So, you know, that there's nothing violent in any of those things. And it was just interesting from that standpoint to read that excerpt, because that was an idea you got there from Letter from Birmingham Jail in that excerpt. That how King felt and thought about some of the black radical movement, some parts of it. But that whole excerpt I read to you, dear listener, was all about challenging the white moderate clergy, the white clergy who had wrote that statement criticizing Dr. King so publicly and so viscerally. And he reminded them, it was actually a reminder, that clip, that part that I read, that Dr. King wrote, a reminder to the white clergy that, hey, have you not forgotten the roots of what we're talking about here? What you're criticizing me about? This is about passion and extremism for love, for making the society and the world a better place. And I would gladly be an extremist in that vein. And look, here are my examples from history and from the Bible. And he's quoting the Bible right back to them. He's quoting history right back to these white clergy. And that was the thing about Dr. King, that he was really quick to point out the hypocrisy of those who would dare challenge the movement and challenge nonviolent civil disobedience. It was about setting a higher moral example. And if you had to be an extremist for love, then you had to be. Then he'd be an extremist every day of the week. And that was the point he was making in that excerpt that you just heard. You have to read Letter from Birmingham Jail in its entirety. It is lengthy, but it is a really good read. And it's a read that will illuminate you if you haven't read it. By the way, you can also find the entirety of Letter from Birmingham Jail in the book Why We Can't Wait. That is a book, of course, written by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And I am going to be giving away a copy of that book. As I said, I will be doing that on Twitter on Monday, which of course is Dr. Martin Luther King Day in the United States, a celebration and observation of his birthday. And that, of course, is a holiday in the United States. So that is coming up. But I want to go on and talk about what happened after the letter from Birmingham Jail, because this is Birmingham, Alabama. And in that same place, Birmingham, literally 5 months after Dr. King wrote that letter, 5 months after he wrote Letter from Birmingham Jail, was the bombing of four little black girls in a Birmingham church, the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing that killed those four little girls on September the 15th, 1963. That's literally 1 day short of exactly 5 months to the day that Dr. King wrote Letter from Birmingham Jail. And again, as I've said before, and I've said a number of times, said it in the part one of this three-part series, and I've said it throughout the time I've been doing the Politocrat Daily podcast, is that context is very important. So Letter from Birmingham Jail is written in the context of white clergy attacking Dr. King for taking the stands he does for his methods of nonviolent civil disobedience. And just 5 months after that, he had the bombing of the church. And I really would like to know where those white moderates stood when those four little black girls were blown to smithereens, blown to bits by a bomb at that church on a Sunday morning. I really would like to know where the same people who wrote the letter and put it in the newspaper attacking Dr. King's methods, I wonder where they stood. Because I haven't researched it. I'm just saying this rhetorically. I wonder where they stood. Just 5 months after that letter was written. I really do. When the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing happened and those four little black girls were blown apart by this bomb, I wonder if that white clergy had anything to say about Dr. King's methods. I wonder if that white clergy had anything to say about that bombing, anything to say about the fact that four little girls were murdered, executed. And the other thing is that just 2 months after that bombing came the assassination of John F. Kennedy, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, the President of the United States, assassinated in plain view. 1963 was a year of shockwaves, as was every year really in the 60s, particularly 63, but especially also 1968. And you obviously know why. Letter from Birmingham Jail came about at a time that was very, very volatile in the United States. But it was a time that had been volatile before in the Civil War and enslavement and a number of other places and other occasions. But in 1963, America was really on a tightrope and a knife's edge. And Dr. King and the many others that joined him in the movement did everything they could to force the United States and force especially white Americans and government to not only pay attention to what was going on with the oppression of black people throughout the South and even beyond the South in the United States, but also to do something about it and act against that oppression and liberate and help join the struggle to liberate black brothers and sisters. That was the obligation and the appeal that Dr. King made. If you are a member of the human family, if you say that you are a member of the human family, then Dr. King declared, it is in your interest, and I'm paraphrasing him, it is in your interest to join us in this community. Join us in this community of love. Join us in this community of spirit. Join us in this community that marches for justice. That is what Dr. King was telling white Americans. The vast majority of those white Americans who sat on the sideline, neutrally and passively, And of course, the white Americans who were racist and openly so, when Dr. King would march through the streets of Birmingham, through the streets of Montgomery, through the streets of Selma, and be met with such hatred and vitriol from the white people who would serenade him with the most vile statements and the most vile signs, with Nazi salutes, with swastikas. I mean, really, end this, end that. It was just horrible. Horrible. Dr. King was not loved by white America, by and large. Was not. The vast majority, and this is really important because this doesn't get said, dear listener. The vast majority of white America detested Dr. King. Now, of course, there, as I've always said, there are obviously people who joined the civil rights movement who were white and who were friends of Dr. King. That was a very, very small group of people. And of course, there were a few white people who sympathized in various parts of the country. But you have to understand, the vast majority of white America despised Dr. King and they hated Malcolm X. And only when Malcolm X really came into his own did some additional white people decide to say, well, you know, I'm more comfortable with Dr. King. But still, even though that said, there were many, many white people who despised King, and not just in the South. Ah, he's a troublemaker. Oh, God, he's a troublemaker. Same way that people despised Reverend Sharpton back in the 1980s and the 1990s. Same way that some white people despised Reverend Sharpton then. And now Reverend Sharpton, if he's not liked by every white person or the vast majority, is at least respected. And now he's become more of a quote-unquote household figure, for lack of a better term. Has his own show on TV and all the rest of it. But you have to understand that where Dr. King is concerned, there were a lot of people who did not like him. And there were some black folk who had differences with him too, as I said, Malcolm X. There were others that would have differences with him later on as he became more of an evolutionary revolutionary, if you will. But this was such an important era in 1963, and that letter from Birmingham jail came out of that era, and it was such a significant time. It really was. In fact, that stretch of time from 63 through 68 was especially crucial. It was a really crucial and volatile time throughout the United States and, of course, across the globe. When I return, more on Dr. King, his evolution revolution, as the late 60s would arrive. That's coming up on this special edition of the Politocrat Daily Podcast, part two of Dr. King Holiday Weekend, right after this.
Days ahead, but it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop. I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place, but I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you. But I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land.
Dr. Martin Luther King there. And Dr. King was a major, major figure, of course, in the fight for voting rights, as was Diane Nash and John Lewis and Amelia Boynton and a whole load of people. I mean, geez, it's just Hosea Williams, I can go on and on. the people who made up that movement and who really did push for voting rights. There were freedom rides, of course, when starting in, I think, 1961 across the South, where buses of black and white voter registrants traveled to register people to vote in the South, register black people to vote in the South. And of course, the freedom rides were disrupted by bombs, fire bombs, and all manner of things, beatings by white men who would beat the black and white freedom riders. And John Lewis took a beating as a freedom rider, as did a number of others. And it was a violent attack on them. And undaunted, freedom riders continued through and continued to do what they were doing. And of course, in 1964, in Philadelphia, Mississippi, Andrew Goodman, Mickey Schwerner, and James Cheney, two white men and one black man, were brutally murdered by the Klan in 1964. It was exactly June the 21st, 1964, in Neshoba County in Philadelphia, Mississippi. And their bodies were found, I think, days later by the FBI or by the police down there. And of course, they were trying to register black people to vote in the South. And the Klan murdered them. So that happened in 1964. And the Civil Rights Bill was passed literally 2 weeks after that, by the way. July the 2nd of 1964, I think was the exact date. That was literally just 2 weeks later. It was, you know, barely 2 weeks later, after those three civil rights workers had been murdered, Goodman, Cheney, and Schwerner. I mean, that is what happened. And I think Goodman and Cheney were from the North. Goodman and Schwerner were from the North. The two white men were from the North. And Cheney was, I believe, from the South. He was from the South. And again, Dr. King spoke on this. He spoke on so many different things, and including that event and so many more. And in 64, the Civil Rights Act was passed, and of course, LBJ signed it. And then the following year, after Bloody Sunday in 1965, March the 7th of 1965, which Dr. King didn't take part in, I think he has stayed out of that particular march, and I now forget the reason why off the top of my head. All of this is from memory that I am telling you this, but from the point of view of the fact that he stayed out of that march, I think he was either on some other function, some other engagement he had to do, or something else, or he was instructed to stay away from the march, and I think perhaps there was some issues around that for his own safety or whatever it was. I forget now. Someone could fill me in on that, because I need to go research it myself, because I don't quite remember how it came to be that he wasn't in that march. But that march on Sunday, March 7th, 1965, was with Hosea Williams and John Lewis and others. And John Lewis was beaten severely in that one. That's the beating that we know all around the world. The world saw this beating on the news, beamed all around the world, these pictures and these bits of tape, archival footage now, but bits of tape of these things happening on the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama. That's one of those critical moments in the civil rights struggle, along with the bombing of the Birmingham church. I mean, those are the kinds of things that began to move some of the white consciousness, some of them, intransigent as it was, but some of the consciousness was being awakened in some of the white people in the country. And this was another moment of it in 65, with the beating of people who were just marching across a bridge. That's what they were doing, and engaging in an act of non-violent civil disobedience, and were protesting. And it wasn't even disobedience. They had a right to march. They were just marching across the bridge, and these police from the state troopers in Montgomery, in Selma, beat them to a pulp on that bridge. It was a very violent attack. These state troopers on horses, the cops on horses doing this, it was very brutal indeed. And these pictures got around the globe and across the country, obviously, and that awakened some people, some white people were awakened by this, and it outraged a lot of people across the globe. And all of this long fight and pressure on then President LBJ, Lyndon Baines Johnson, who is a Dixiecrat at heart, he was. And all that pressure and a lot more that Dr. King put on him, the movement put on him to sign the Voting Rights Bill. And that's exactly what happened in August of 1965. So Dr. King and the movement had a very significant imprint on this country in the 1960s. It was revolutionary, revolutionary. And you, to the point in which you got LBJ on TV at one point, even invoking the words of the civil rights movement, "We shall overcome." You know, that was one of the anthems of the civil rights movement. And it was a moment that a lot of people realized and recognized that LBJ had finally been brought in, finally had an awakening. And that was all because of Dr. King and the movement, the civil rights movement, that pushed LBJ to have a role in being on the right side of history. And how different is it now? How different are we now? How different? We've gone completely backwards. Because I do want to tie what Dr. King did and the ramifications of all of what happened in that time period in the 1960s to right now in 2022 and beyond 2022, years from now. We've slid backwards in the United States. We went from LBJ being pushed and prodded and forced, quite frankly, to do the right thing, to a couple of senators in the United States Senate on the Democratic side who turned around and reverted to Dixiecrat behavior and decided to block, completely block, voting rights by not choosing to change the filibuster rules to effectuate a vote on voting rights. So in almost 60 years later, we've gone completely backwards past 1965. And that really shows you how precious these times are, how precious the times were then when Dr. King and others made LBJ do it, as the saying goes. LBJ said, "Well, make me do it. If you want this voting rights, if you want this legislation, make me do it." And that's exactly what Dr. King and the movement did. John Lewis had a massive hand in that, as did many others, as I've said. And as a result, voting rights were signed on August the 7th of 1965. I believe that was the exact date. And there were successive presidents of the United States who reauthorized that Voting Rights Act, including Ronald Reagan, including Tricky Dick Nixon, including both Bushes. These are Republican presidents. But now you've got Republicans who won't even dare debate voting rights. That's where we are now in this year, 2022. Dr. King fought and fought for voting rights. He fought very hard for them. But he also fought for another constituency, the poor. And as he began to evolve, and in 1965, of course, that same year, Malcolm X had been assassinated. And by the time that Malcolm X had, just before he was assassinated, the vision of Dr. King and Malcolm X converged. And there have been many books written about this, one or two of them. One of them is called Malcolm and Martin. I forget who wrote it. But their visions converged. Malcolm was less of a Nation of Islam person because he left the Nation of Islam after the fallout with the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and then started his own organization, the OAAU, the Organization of Afro-American Unity, a more Pan-Africanist organization, an organization that was much broader. I talked earlier about movements being broader and how Dr. King grew the movement from the inside and out. The Nation of Islam was not that kind of movement. But Malcolm X grew a movement himself with the OAAU, Organization of Afro-American Unity, as I said, and for Afro-American Unity. That's what the acronym stood for. And Dr. King did the same thing. Their visions converged. Dr. King became more of a radical, more of a universalist, as Malcolm X, more of a radical, more of someone who believed that the United States government was doing all the wrong things, certainly in Vietnam, but the Beyond Vietnam speech, of course, in 1967, and before that, with a number of other things. And Malcolm became more of a Pan-Africanist and more of a humanist just before he passed away, within the last year of his life. The pilgrimage to Mecca after he had been cast out of the nation or after he left the Nation of Islam. And then all of the things he really began to see so clearly. You can read the autobiography of Malcolm X, and he talks about this in great detail in the last few chapters. But Malcolm began to sound a bit more like the humanist that Dr. King, that Martin always was. And Martin began to sound like the radical, the black radical that Malcolm X had started out as, had always been up to a point until he left the Nation of Islam. And in that speech in 1965, when Malcolm was assassinated, Dr. King did say that it was a horrible day for the nation, and terrible. And he said it indicates, I'm paraphrasing, that we cannot agree about being violently disagreeable. And that's something that was really true, obviously, in the case of the assassination of Malcolm X, who was a peaceful human being, just like all of the black people who were murdered were during the 1960s. And any time, we are peaceful people, you know, overwhelmingly. And then Dr. King, in that speech Beyond Vietnam in 1967, April 4th of 1967, and 1 year later he would be assassinated. Dr. King challenged the United States government, challenged its ways, challenged what it was doing, and he grew a movement. There were people who abandoned Dr. King. There were black ministers who abandoned him. There were white ministers who abandoned him when he gave that speech Beyond Vietnam, or Why I'm Opposed to the Vietnam War, at the Riverside Church in Harlem, USA, on April 4th, 1967. It was a robust speech. It was a really important speech. Crucial. Challenged the three, and I talked about this in the previous episode, challenged the three evils of America: militarism, racism, and poverty. And really questioned the ethos and the mindset and the mentality of the United States and the government. And that was the thing, as he decried the war in Vietnam. And the bombs and the money being spent on bombs and all the rest of it, but not on books, not on education, not on housing. And this was a powerful rebuke at the government, and it was an important one. It had to be made. And that was when the government started to really look at Dr. King and train their lenses on him. And the forces behind government did that too. It's all right for you to go talk about them civil rights you're talking about. When you start talking about government, well, that's a different thing, brother. You ain't doing that around here. And not without a price. That was basically the attitude. And King had very few allies back in 1967. And there were lots of people who despised him then, white and black. They grew uncomfortable with the fact that Dr. King elevated his consciousness even more and then challenged the instrumentality and the power structure of the United States. That was what gave King even greater notoriety amongst some of the people who didn't like him to begin with, and certainly put him on the radar of the FBI. The FBI had spied on him for a number of years. J. Edgar Hoover did with the COINTELPRO program, the counterintelligence program. That was a very nefarious and very despicable group program that had people trying to undermine black movements and had black people in those movements trying to undermine them and bring them down, and would send white women to try to bring them down, to instigate affairs amongst some of the black men in these groups in order to collect intelligence and to bring these organizations down and infiltrate them and subvert them. Dr. King was wiretapped, he was spied on, and yes, did they catch Dr. King committing acts of infidelity? Yes, he did. As I said, Dr. King was not a saint by any stretch. This is what the FBI did. They spied on black people constantly, especially in those movements. Spied on them. And Dr. King had to deal with that. He had to deal with a whole lot in that era. The Beyond the Vietnam speech, Beyond Vietnam, very important speech. And there was no accident that exactly 1 year later he was murdered. That was not by some kind of happenstance. That the exact date that he gave the speech the year before would be the exact date a year after that he would be assassinated. And just before he was, the last previous day or two of his life, he had been in Memphis, Tennessee, growing out the movement, advocating for poor people in the Poor People's Campaign, advocating for Memphis workers in the garbage workers' strike. That's what he was on. He was on the picket lines with them. And that doesn't get talked about enough. I talked about it in the previous episode, but that's what he was doing. He was growing his movement out, growing the civil rights movement out to become that human rights struggle that it always was, to back up the speech that he had gave just a year before at the Riverside Church, talking about those three evils, poverty being one of them, in the richest nation on earth. Dr. King was in his final days, literally, marching with the Memphis garbage workers in Memphis, Tennessee, to back them in their strike. That's what Dr. King died doing. And he was shot dead at the Lorraine Hotel, the Lorraine Motel, actually, in Memphis, Tennessee. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was a figure beyond compare. And in the next episode, I will continue to talk about Dr. King, and you'll hear from Dr. King more clearly himself in a very important speech, one that you've probably never heard before, and one I've never played before here on the Politocrat Daily Podcast. So don't forget to join me again tomorrow for the third of three episodes, very special episodes, of the Politocrat Daily Podcast, as we continue here on Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. holiday weekend. Thank you very much for listening to this edition of the Politocrat. I'm Omar Moore.